We're in Haggai chapter 2, verses 1 to 9 tonight, calling God's people to service and hope of future blessings over current discouragement. Someone has said that discouragement is Satan's favorite tool, because if he can't lure us by a temptation, if he can't lure us by getting us angry or something or afraid, then he has his favorite tools. He pulls it out as the tool of discouragement. And he takes that tool and he rubs it in on the Christian. And before you know it, a lot of times he just kind of gives up. You know? That's quite an illustration. But anyway, discouragement can so diffuse our motivation that we cease to trust and serve God for blessings. God addressed Israel's great discouragement in Haggai chapter 2, verse 9, with instructions for us today. You know, I was thinking by way of an illustration of the financial needs of our body. We're going to be having a board, not a church meeting on March 22nd in view of the current financial challenge. We, as a board, we received news from our church treasurer that normally he pays the missionaries on the second Sunday or the second week of the month. And there wasn't enough money to do that without draining the cash level way down. So he had held up on that. And, you know, hoping that more money would come in. But it can't hold up too long because you run into next week's budget, next month's budget, and so forth. Well, I've got a very encouraging illustration to use when we close the sermon in regards to this. But I just thought, you know, sometimes that can get discouraging, especially, I mean, we're living in a time when finances are, you know, that's the big issue that's affecting our world, let alone our own country at this particular time. So it's easy to get discouraged. Well, believe it or not, I found this to be a marvelous passage in view of this whole issue. The returned exiles in Haggai chapter 2, verses 1 to 9, were discouraged for several reasons, as Haggai gave in his Haggai chapter 2, verses 1 through 9 message. The people were discouraged since their efforts seemed to be so incompetent compared to other efforts. Let me read the passage and then we'll look at it. Haggai chapter 2, verse 1 through 9. In the seventh month, in the month, the first and 20th day of the month, came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai, saying, "Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, who is the governor of Judah, to Joshua, the son of Jotzadak, the high priest, and say to the residue, or the remainder of this people, saying, Who is left among you that saw this temple in her initial glory?" This would be the Solomon temple. And of course, the temple was destroyed during the Babylonian captivity. "How do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes as in comparison of it as nothing? Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, the son of Jotzadak, the high priest. And be strong, O you people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. According to the word that I covenanted with you when you came up out of Egypt, so my spirit remains among you. Fear ye not. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens, and the earth, and the sea, and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. The silver is mine, the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. The glory of this latter temple shall be greater than the former, saith the Lord of hosts. And in this place I will give peace, saith the Lord of hosts." What a wonderful passage. Anyway, let's look at it. We know from Haggai chapter 2, verse 3, where God is saying, "Who's left among you who saw this temple in her first glory? In your eyes, is it not now as comparison as nothing?" We know from Haggai 2:3, in light of Ezra 3:8-13, that in the second month of the same year that the message of Haggai chapter 2, verses 1 to 9 was spoken, elderly Jews who had seen Solomon's past great temple had sown seeds of discouragement in the returned exiles when they had wept over the current temple's ruined state. Let me just get back to Ezra chapter 3. We'll look at that. And remember, this is something that happened. Ezra chapter 3, verses 8 to 13, occurred five months before this event. In the second year of their coming into the house of God at Jerusalem, this is Ezra chapter 3, verse 8, in the second month began Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jotzadak, and the remnant of the brethren, the priests, the Levites, and all they that were come out of the captivity to Jerusalem, and appointed the Levites from 20 years of age and upwards to set forward the work of the house of God. And of course, verses 9 and 10 and 11 talks about how they celebrated and they praised the Lord. But notice verse 12. But many of the priests and the Levites and the chief of the fathers who were elderly men, who had seen the first temple, that would be Solomon's temple, when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept aloud with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard far off. See, they were weeping because here they were. They were not skilled people. They were just exiles that had come back out of Babylon. And they were attempting to take stones that had been broken down and a lot of them cracked and so forth. And they were rebuilding a temple that doesn't look nearly as beautiful as Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple had been quarried and built by skilled men from Tyre. The Phoenicians were expert at these stoneworks. They had beautiful stoneworks that we've seen. I mean, they fit within a hairbreadth. I mean, these stones, I don't know how they did it, but they were expert. And these people aren't experts. And, you know, the stones have cracks, and you can probably see through them as they're piled up. So it's just not as lovely as the first one. And so these people are grieving over the fact that, you know, it's not like it used to be. How many times have we heard elderly people say that? You know, it's just not like the good old times. Yeah. Yeah, we're the ones that are doing the complaining now, huh? Oh, yeah. I used to hear the old folks do it, and now we're doing that, huh? Oh, boy, that dates us, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, anyway, this discouragement had festered for 5 months, all right? And I'll tell you, when you get some discouraging news and you think about it for, you know, not just 5 weeks, but 5 months, it really gnaws at you and just gets you down. And that's what happened with these people. It gnawed them, got them down. And when Haggai chapter 2, 1 to 9 was spoken, it had spawned feelings of incompetence among the exiles over trying to rebuild a very inferior temple. verses 2 and 3 of Haggai chapter 2, speak now to Zerubbabel, and speak to Joshua and say, who is left among you who saw this house in her first glory, and how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison as nothing? They laid the foundation, but the old-timers are saying, this isn't any good. So, you know, what does that do to you? You've been working hard trying to set the foundation, and they say it's not anything like the first temple. You feel like, well, why build it anymore? All they're going to do is critique it. Have you ever been in a situation like that where your best efforts seem to be absolutely inferior to someone else's? Or, you know, someone else can do it better, so why even try? I think every human being's been in that situation before. Well, that's exactly where these people fell. And the people were also discouraged since a recent fast day had exposed their lack of blessing due to past sin. The date of Haggai chapter 2, verses 1 to 9 message was the 21st of the 7th month, the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles that usually celebrated God's harvest bounty. If you'll remember, we in our prayer meeting, I think last year, we were in Leviticus chapter 23, 39 to 44. And the last day, there are 8 days of this feast. The last day was a day of celebration, which they celebrated the feasts. Because these feasts, they celebrated the harvest because there had been a bountiful harvest. Well, we had found out last week that there had not been a good harvest because the people had sinned. In verse 9 of chapter 1, for example, God said, you looked for much, and lo, it came little. And when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, saith the Lord of hosts? Because mine house that is waste, and you run every man into his own house. See, they were building up their own houses rather than the temple of the Lord, so God had cut back on their harvest. And verse 10, therefore the heaven over you stayed from dew, the earth has stayed from her fruit. I called for a drought on the land and upon the mountains and upon the grain and upon the new wine, upon the oil and upon that which the ground brings forth and upon men and upon cattle, upon all the labor of your hands. So here they are. This is the feast day. They're supposed to be celebrating the bounty of God, and there's not much bounty there because God has judged them because of their sin in the past. They've repented. They're back building the temple. But it's very discouraging. So they're discouraged because of the lack in the harvest. And then, for their having failed to use their material resources for the temple reconstruction, God had hindered their harvest, and so he had diminished their cause for joy at the current feast day. So it pointed to sin. And then the people were discouraged since the many feast days of that 7th month include the weekly Sabbaths, the Feast of Trumpets on the first day, the Day of Atonement on the 10th of that month, the Feast of Booths from Tishri 15 to 12, and with Tishri 22 also being a rest day, it had interrupted their work and it made them hard to want to return. I mean, they had been working, they'd been in the groove, but now they've had all these breaks. And who wants to get back? You know, who wants to get back to that? That's the old drudgery. Ron Cassiano, who used to be in our church, said years ago he'd taken up the idea, he thought he was going to build his own house. Well, he's not a builder himself. And he said, after a number of months of that, he would show up at the house and it was so discouraging, he couldn't do any work. All he could do is just sit down there and maybe drink a cup of coffee and just look at the rafters. You know, the joists that were going over. He said it was too overwhelming. He finally ended up, getting Dwayne Dute and someone else to help him. And so, these guys, they're skilled at this. They could finish the work in just a matter of weeks. But with Ron, it was enormous. And so these people were discouraged as well. And finally, the laborious task of cleaning up 60 years of rubble further drained their motivation. Remember, you've got stones that are falling down. When Nehemiah, for example, took his horse and he wanted to ride out and survey the area, he couldn't even go all the way around the city because the rocks and the stones that had been thrown down were so great, the horse couldn't even pass. Normally, horses can kind of get up and cross, but he couldn't even go past it. So you imagine there's an enormous amount. They probably had to spend weeks just clearing off the area where the platform of the temple foundation had been, just clearing that off. Then they have to turn around and they have to start aligning up the rocks and the stones and trying to lay a foundation. That took another amount of work. So there were all these discouragements. Accordingly, God addressed Israel's discouragement with the uplifting message of chapter 2, verses 1 to 9 that we read tonight. First of all, God told Haggai to speak to the leaders of Israel, their governors, Zerubbabel, and their high priest, Joshua, indicating that the attitude of the leaders set the tone for overcoming discouragement. I take this personally. I think the Lord is indicating, Don, you've got to encourage the flock. Because if you're not encouraged, it's going to drag them down. I've used this illustration many times. You can take a man, if he comes home from work and he's grouchy because of what's happened at work, in 15 minutes he can get the rest of the household grouchy. Because he has a tendency to lead in the emotional tenor of the home. On the other hand, if the wife's had a bad day, the children have had a bad day, the husband comes home and he's upbeat, in 15 minutes he can get them all upbeat because he has a tremendous impact. And it's interesting how God talked to Zerubbabel, who's the governor, and he talked to the high priest. And he says God's with and to the people. But he's after the leaders because the leaders are going to set the tone. So we've got to watch ourselves. I work with the board on this and we try to work on this because our attitude, we know, will set the attitude of the body. So it's very important for the leaders to watch it. Then the Lord revealed that he knew of the lament of the elderly mourners who had contrasted the temple's current poor state to Solomon's temple and of its discouraging effects on the workers. I think this is important in verse 3. Who is left among you who saw this temple in her initial glory? How do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison as nothing? Now, keep in mind, this is God. The way he builds temple, he paves the streets with gold. He makes the gates out of a solid pearl. So, you know, God knows what beauty is. And he says, you're comparing this to Solomon's temple. Of course, Solomon's temple is just, so-so. It's not anything like what you have in heaven. But anyway, he says, you're comparing this to Solomon's temple, aren't you? And you're discouraged over that, aren't you? And, of course, they know. This is neat because God knows what makes us discouraged. See, if we're here tonight and we're discouraged about something, God is very, very aware of that. And he knows why it's making us discouraged. Because he reads our minds and our hearts. Well, to counter the discouragement, God said that he was with them in their effort. So even if they did not have skilled workmen as Solomon had, God would make their work effective. Boy, is this encouraging. Verse 4, yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel. And this is strong in reference to discouragement, saith the Lord. And be strong, O Joshua. In other words, fight off this discouragement. And be strong, all you people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. I would have to say, in the last year, the Lord has revealed his presence to me in wonderful ways. I'll get into that office and I'll sit down and start studying the Sunday morning service, the evening service, the prayer meeting service, and invariably, a concern or a question or an issue that's on my mind, I sit down and the next passage I have to prepare addresses it right on. And this past week, I pointed out in the sermon this morning, I was preparing the sermon. I had it on, up on the monitor on the screen there, the computer, the word processor and that I work, and I got a call from a family in the church who were concerned about something. And after talking with them, I looked at the monitor and I said, "Can I read off the title of the sermon this Sunday?" And they kind of chuckled. So I read it, you know, and they were astounded. I said, "It's right here." And in fact, if you want to read in preparation for the Sunday sermon, it's Genesis 47 there. It's how to think in the midst of an overwhelming trial. A lot of times when we get into trials, it's mind-numbing. Well, this passage dealt with that. How did Joseph deal with an overwhelming trial? He followed the word of God, and that's how he saw his way. So God encourages us. And there's nothing, I tell you what, to see the Lord working in your life, there's no better joy, there's no greater fulfillment than to God to signal himself with you. And that's what he says, "I'm with you. I want you to know I am with you." That's tremendous encouragement. Then, God also reminded the returned exiles that just as he had been with them as a people when they left Egypt as a nation of slaves, he was now with them to make their end glorious, just as he had caused their forefathers as a nation of fresh out of Egypt to become glorious in Solomon's era. Verse 5, "According to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remains among you. Fear you not." Now that would have brought back encouragement, because when they came out of Egypt, they were slaves. They were scared to death. And they were leaving the most powerful man of his day, Pharaoh. He was a monarch. He owned his own people and everything. We found that from the lesson this morning. But they left. And the Lord parted the Red Sea so that they could go through on that. And then the Lord closed the Red Sea upon that powerful man and his commanders and the chariots and destroyed them. And the people were astounded when they saw the power of God. And then God took them as a nation of slaves across the wilderness. He fed them for 40 years. He took them into the land. And then they built them up and gave them this marvelous temple under Solomon. God says, "Look, I've helped you before. When you were really down and out, I brought you up. You're down and out now. So, we've been there before. Cheer up. I've brought you from slavery before. I've brought you out of Babylon. Now, I'm going to build you up. So be encouraged." This is something we need to remember. What has God done for us in the past? My dad pastored a church in Gridley, California. It was a Baptist church there. And their favorite song was "Count Your Blessings." Because when you count your blessings and see what God's done for you, you cheer up because you realize, wow, you know, why am I complaining now? Look what he's done for me to get me just to here. So that's what the Lord says. He reminded them of what he had done for them in the past and that he was going to make their end glorious. Indeed, God promised one day to shake the heavens, the earth, the sea, the dry land, causing the wealth. Now, the desire here is often translated to be the Messiah, but in the context, it's a collective noun in the Hebrew. That means desirable things or treasures. So we can translate it that. God will bring the treasures of all the nations to be brought and to glorify the latter temple with gold and silver. See, God, he likens the nations as having money trees. So he's going to shake the heavens and the sea and the dry land. He's going to shake them all. And he's going to bring all that wealth and he's going to bring it back. Now, he's obviously looking forward to the Messianic temple, but of course, they thought the Messianic era was going to occur when Messiah came. They didn't know anything about the inter-period of the church period in between that. But nevertheless, God is saying, "I can, you know, the silver is mine, the gold's mine. I can control it." So this is another reason why we shouldn't be concerned about money at this time. It's God's. The silver is God's, the gold is God's. Gold is going now around $900 an ounce, you know, because of the economic situation. It had been down to 280 some dollars, I think, a number of years ago. Well, the gold is God's. The silver is God's. He can handle that. So, we have a song, "He Owns the Cattle on the Thousand Hills." He does. In fact, that's a reference to a verse in the Bible. So God promised one day to shake the heavens, the earth, the sea, the dry land, causing the wealth of all the nations to be brought and to glorify the latter temple with silver and gold. Now, what's interesting is that this contrasts with God spoiling just the one nation, Egypt, for Israel in the Exodus. Remember, God introduced the idea of the Exodus back in verse 5. Well, if you go back to the book of Exodus, when they came out of Egypt, see what the Lord did for them in spoiling that one nation when he brought them out. Exodus chapter 12, verses 35 and 36. And the children of Israel did according to the word of Moses, and they borrowed or took from the Egyptians jewels of silver and jewels of gold and clothing. This would be fine clothing. This would be like a thin linen that the Egyptians made. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they gave unto them such things as they required, and they spoiled the Egyptians. So God has taken them out once before, he spoiled. Now God says in the future kingdom, I'm not just going to spoil one nation, all the nations. The Gentiles are going to pour their money into this thing. And of course we know from the book of Ezekiel that the temple in the Messianic kingdom is going to be much larger than Solomon's. You're going to have geographical changes on Mount Zion just to hold this thing. But it's going to be a massive temple, much more expensive and much more glorious. And of course, Christ in his Shekinah glory is going to be sitting on the throne in the temple. It's a marvelous thing. So anyway, the glory of the latter temple then would be greater than the temple that the elderly had so badly missed. In verse 9, it says, the glory of this latter house would be greater than the former. If you take that together with the verse 3, where the people are weeping because they're saying that the current temple isn't like the first temple, God says, you know what? You haven't seen your best temple yet. Your best temple's in the future. It's not in the past. So you need to look forward. So God is doing a lot of correcting here. And then indeed, God would do something that he didn't provide in Solomon's temple. In Solomon's temple, the people really did not know that deep-seated peace. But with the outpouring of the Holy Spirit in the Messianic kingdom that is to come, there's going to be peace. So God would provide peace, full spiritual blessings in the Messianic temple opposite the lesser blessings of Solomon's era, peace that would end laments like the elderly had expressed. That's why he says in verse 9, and in this place, this temple, I will give peace, saith the Lord of hosts. So in application, in applying God's message to the returned exiles, may we handle the temptation to be discouraged as we seek to do God's assignments by recalling that God is with us as we do his will to make our seemingly meager efforts effective. That the God who brought Israel from slavery in Egypt in the Exodus to the glories of Solomon's kingdom is just as able to advance us and our works for his glory as he did for ancient Israel. And by trusting that God can do so much more for us in the future than he's done for us even in the past, including giving us greater spiritual blessings than he's ever before provided. Okay, I've got an illustration to use. We had mentioned in the beginning of the lesson tonight that the board had received word from the treasurer that there wasn't really enough money there to pay for the missionaries the next week. Well, I was talking with the treasurer today. Someone had mailed him a check for a sizable amount of money, which is going to, and that happened during the week, between last Sunday and this Sunday, and he's got that, so now that's been helpful. We also learned at the board meeting that, you know, the new furnace that we have that was donated, this year already, over last year, it has saved us over $1,770 in fuel. That furnace is going to pay for itself in 4 years. That's a blessing, because where would we be if we didn't have that? You know, we'd be $1,770 further, you know, and more of a challenge. So I think we need to be encouraged. I know we need to be encouraged. God wants us to be encouraged. Sometimes he allows us to get into situations like he did the children of Israel here, because he's just trying to demonstrate his power. And sometimes he can't do that unless we get to the point where we actually see the need. We actually need God all the time. A lot of times we don't realize it. You know, it's easy to kind of psychologically depend on the checking account or depend on the health that we already have instead of really trusting the Lord all the time. But the Lord wants us to be encouraged. He's with us. He will make our efforts effective, so we shouldn't give up just because they look like they're not quite as classy as someone else's. He's the God who's helped the children of Israel come from slavery to Solomon's temple. He can do that again for us. God can do a lot more for us than what he's done in the past. And God can give us greater spiritual blessings than what we've had before. So we need to be encouraged.